This is Audible.
Penguin Audio presents Demon by Daniel Suarez. Read by Jeff Gerner with Garrett Scott.
D-A-E-M-O-N. Demon. Noun. A computer program that runs continuously in the background and performs specified operations at predefined times, or in response to certain events. Condensed from Disk and Execution Monitor.
Part 1. Chapter 1. Execution.
Reuters.com Business. Matthew A. Sobel, Ph.D., co-founder and chief technology officer of CyberStorm Entertainment, HSTM NASDAQ, died today at age 34 after a prolonged battle with brain cancer. A pioneer in the $40 billion computer game industry, Sobel was the architect of CyberStorm's best-selling online games, Over the Rhine and The Gate. CyberStorm CEO Kenneth Kivolt describes Sobel as a tireless innovator and a rare intellect.
What the hell just happened?
That was all Joseph Pavlos kept thinking as he clenched a gloved hand against his throat. It didn't stop the blood from pulsing between his fingers. Already a shockingly wide pool had formed in the dirt next to his face. He was on the ground somehow. Although he couldn't see the gash, the pain told him the wound was deep. He rolled onto his back and stared up at a stretch of spotless blue sky. His usually methodical mind sped frantically through the possibilities, like someone groping for an exit in a smoke-filled building. He had to do something, anything, but what? The phrase,
"What the hell just happened?"
kept echoing in his head uselessly, while blood kept spurting between his fingers. Adrenaline surged through his system, his heart beating faster. He tried to call out. No good. Blood squirted several inches into the air and sprinkled his face.
Carotid artery.
He was pressing on his neck so hard he was almost strangling himself.
And he'd been feeling so good just moments before this. He remembered that much, at least. His last debts repaid at long last.
He was getting calmer now, which was strange. He kept trying to remember what he'd been doing, what brought him here to this place. It seemed so unimportant now. His hand began to relax its hold. He could see plainly that there was no emergency, because there was no logical scenario by which he would emerge from this alive. And after all, it was his unequaled talent for logic that had brought Pavlos so far in life, had brought him halfway around the world. This was it. He'd already done everything he would ever do. His peripheral vision began to constrict, and he felt like an observer. He was calm now. And it was in that cold, detached state that he realized. Matthew Sobel had died. That's what the news said. And then it all made sense to him. Sobel's game finally made sense. It was beautiful, really.
Clever men.
Chapter 2. Rogue Process. Thousand Oaks, California had an overzealous sanitary charm. They didn't build homes here, they manufactured them. 100 identical Mediterranean villas at a stroke. Gated subdivisions named in every combination of bridge, haven, glen, and lake covered the hillsides. Upscale retail chains had embassies in the city center, and the service people drove in each day from vassal communities. Where the medieval city of Lyon had its lane of tanners, Southern California had its vale of the baristas and canyon of firefighters and rescue personnel. For average working folks, America was becoming a puzzle. Who was buying all these $200 copper saucepans anyway? And how was everyone paying for these BMWs? Were people shrewd or just stupefyingly irresponsible? Pete Seebeck thought television held some clues. Channel surfing late at night, unable to sleep, Seebeck considered the commercials aimed at him. Was he their demographic? Had they correctly deduced him? And what did that say about him? The History Channel seemed to think he was either a Korean War veteran looking for a truly capable brush mower, or that he was desperately in need of a career change. He had a nasty suspicion they were right about one of them. The 101 freeway cut Thousand Oaks in two, but there really was no wrong side of the freeway. It had been named the safest small city in America. And as Detective Sergeant Peter Seebeck watched the tidy boulevards roll past his passenger window, he recalled why he and Laura moved here 13 years ago, back when it was affordable. Ventura County was a great place to raise children. If you fucked up raising kids here, then God himself could not have helped you. Migraine Pete! Seebeck turned to Nathan Mance, looking at him with concern from the driver's seat. Seebeck barely shook his head. Mance knew better than to pursue it. Seebeck thought about the radio call from Burkow. It would certainly rattle a few country club gates. Seebeck and Mance cruised through town with the strobes flashing, but no siren. No need to alarm anyone. From his unmarked Crown Victoria, Seebeck watched the unsuspecting citizenry, the tax base on power walks. They'd have something to talk about tonight at Pilates class. The Crown Vic descended into the undeveloped canyons just beyond the last subdivision wall. The scene wasn't difficult to find. An ambulance, three patrol units, and a few unmarked cars on the sandy shoulder of Potrero Road marked the location. Two deputy sheriffs stood near a closed steel gate flanked by chain-link fence stretching out in either direction. Mance rolled the cruiser into the driveway before the gate. Seebeck stepped from the car and turned to the nearest officer.
Coroner?
En route, Sergeant.
Where's Detective Burkow?
The deputy thumbed in the direction of a hole cut in the side of the chain-link fence. Seebeck waited for Mance, who was radioing in. Seebeck looked back at the deputy.
Let's get this gate open.
Can't, Sergeant. It's got one of those remote control locks built into it. There's nothing to cut.
Seebeck nodded as Mance caught up to him.
The property is owned by a local company, Cyberstorm Entertainment. We got through to their people. They're sending someone down.
Seebeck moved through the hole in the fence, followed by Mance. They marched along a dirt road, winding among the chaparral on the canyon bottom. Soon they came to a crowd of EMTs and deputy sheriffs standing well back from a photographer. They were all shiny with sweat in the midday sun. The paramedics had a gurney, but no one was in a hurry. They turned as Seebeck and Mance crunched across the dirt toward them.
Afternoon, gentlemen.
A glance.
Ladies.
They mumbled greetings and parted to let Seebeck and Mance pass. Detective Martin Burkow, a corpulent man in his 50s with ill-fitting pants, stood on a mound of sandy soil at the edge of the road. Next to him, the police photographer leaned forward to get an overhead shot of a body lying in the road. A pool of brownish, dried blood stretched out beneath it and traced dark rivulets downhill. Seebeck gazed over the scene. A motocross motorcycle lay 20 yards down the road on the side of a nearby hill. He could see where it bounded into the left wall of the canyon and then rolled back across the dirt road. Above the road, between him and the body, a taut steel cable stretched at neck level. The cable traversed the road at a 45-degree angle, closer on the left side, farther away on the right. Anything racing through here would grind down the cable like a saw blade. The cable was bloodstained for a good 10-foot length. The body lay 10 yards beyond that, a motorcycle helmet 5 yards farther still. Seebeck's eyes followed the thin steel cable rightward to a steel pole rising from the chaparral, then leftward through the bushes. A freshly cut groove crossed the dirt roadway directly beneath the cable.
Martin, what do we have?
Detective Burkow coughed the consumptive cough of a lifelong smoker.
Hi, Pete. Thanks for coming down. Caucasian male, approximately 30 years old. A local walking his dog found the body about an hour ago. It was reported as a 1054, but I thought I'd call you guys. This is looking more like a 187.
Seebeck and Mance looked at each other and raised their eyebrows. Homicide. Rare in Thousand Oaks. The only killings made down here were in real estate. The photographer nodded to Burkow and made his way back along the edge of the road. Burkow motioned for them to move forward.
Stick to the left in the ruts. All the footprints are on the other side.
He stepped down off the mound. Seebeck and Mance ducked under the cable and stood over the body. Seebeck was relieved to see the head still attached. The nearby helmet was empty. The dead man wore an expensive-looking motocross jumpsuit with logo patches. The yellow nylon was torn at chest level. It looked like he hit the cable with his torso, and it rode up to his throat. The man's larynx was slashed, and flies buzzed over the gaping wound. His skin was alabaster white, and his lusterless, dry eyes stared at Seebeck's shoes. Seebeck pulled on rubber surgical gloves and leaned forward. He felt for a wallet or ID in the pockets. There didn't appear to be any. He looked ahead at the dirt bike, then back at the police photographer.
"Carrie, try to read the plates on the bike. Maybe we can ID this guy."
The photographer peered down the canyon, then affixed a 200mm lens to his camera and focused on the motorcycle. Seebeck stood up, and his eyes once again traversed the cable behind them. He peered through the bushes where it disappeared.
"Anybody know where this ends?"
The deputies and EMTs shook their heads.
"Nathan, let's follow this thing. Stay clear of it and look for tracks."
He turned back to Burkow.
"Marty, what are all these footprints on the road?"
The locals walk it all the time. I've already interviewed a few."
"Get me a cast of every unique print in this area."
Seebeck waved his arms downward.
"That's gonna be a lot of prints."
"Tell forensics they don't have to cast the dog tracks."
Mance grinned.
"I don't know. I hear Pekingese are pretty smart."
Seebeck shot him a dark look and pointed at the bushes. The cable led through a gap in the hillside that opened up back onto Potrero Road. He and Mance fanned out on either side and moved through the bushes while studying the sandy ground.
"Keep an eye out for rattlesnakes, Pete."
Mance jumped over a ditch of eroded soil. The cable was easy to follow, and the groove in the soil beneath it shadowed it all the way. After 60 feet, they were back at the chain-link fence on Potrero Road, staring at the back of a no-trespassing sign. The cable ran through the fence and into the back of a steel box 2 feet square, sitting atop a thick pipe driven into the ground. The groove in the soil ended 6 feet away from the fence on their side. They had found no new footprints.
"Let's head to the other side."
In a few minutes, they were back on Potrero Road at the gate. They walked 100 yards down the shoulder and reached the front of the steel box. It had a sturdy lock in its face and was fashioned of welded steel. It had a few indentations where passing teens had taken pot shots at it with rifles, but none had penetrated.
"Built to last."
Seebeck peered around to a square hole in back where the cable entered.
"Winch housing?"
Mance nodded.
"At first I thought it might be kids playing an evil prank, but this is a serious piece of engineering. What use could this thing serve?"
They turned as a Range Rover and a pickup truck pulled to the shoulder of the road near the gate. A couple of guys in khakis got out of the Rover. They spoke briefly with the deputies there, who pointed down to Seebeck and Mance. The khakis climbed back in the Rover. Both vehicles rolled down the shoulder and stopped in front of the detectives, sending a choking cloud of dust over them both. The khakis got out again. The one on the passenger side came forward with his hand extended. He looked like money. Business casual with creases.
"Detectives, Gordon Pietro, senior legal counsel for Cyberstorm Entertainment."
They shook hands. Pietro pushed business cards on both of them.
"This is our VP of Public Relations, Ron Massey."
Seebeck nodded. Massey had longer hair than Pietro and a pierced eyebrow with a gold ring. He was in his late 20s and looked like money, too. A pang of jealousy shot through Seebeck. The fact that he could effortlessly beat the shit out of this kid sprang unbidden into his mind. He pushed it back down.
"This is Detective Mance. I'm Detective Sergeant Seebeck,
Ventura County Major Crimes Unit."
Pietro stopped short.
"Major Crimes Unit? We were told there was an accidental death on the property."
"The responding officers called us in. We're investigating this as a potential homicide."
Seebeck leaned around Pietro and looked at the pickup truck parked behind the Rover. The pickup had a logo on the side door, illegible at this angle.
"Who's in the truck?"
"Oh, a worker from the management firm. They maintain the property. He has a remote for the front gate."
"Let's get him out here. I want to talk to him."
Pietro walked back, motioning to the guy in the truck. Seebeck turned to Massey.
"What's this property used for?"
"Cyberstorm purchased the land as an investment. It's also used by the company for campouts, team-building exercises, things like that."
Seebeck took out a pad and pen.
"So, you're the PR guy? What's Cyberstorm Entertainment do, Ron?"
"We're a computer game developer. Ever hear of Over the Rhine?
No.
Berkow shouted from down near the gate.
Pete! I got a name from the DMV. The bike's registered to a Joseph Pavlos. Lives up in those McMansions on the hilltop.
Massey put a hand to his chin.
Oh, man. You know the victim?
Yeah, he's one of our senior developers. What happened?
Seebeck gestured with his pen.
He hit this cable with his neck. Do you know if he rode down here regularly?
I don't, but his development team might.
Pietro returned with a Mexican man in his 40s dressed in a green jumpsuit. The guy looked like he'd had a tough life, and that he expected it to get a lot tougher any second.
Ron? Pavla's the one killed?
Massey nodded and produced a cell phone.
Damn this canyon, can't get a signal.
Pietro produced his phone for a bar count contest.
What service do you use? I have 2 bars.
Seebeck butted in.
You are?
Pietro turned back to him.
This is Jaime.
What's your full name, Jaime?
Jaime Alvarez Jimenez, senor.
Can I see some identification, Mr. Jimenez?
What's going on?
There's been a fatality. Can I have that ID, please?
Jaime looked at Pietro and Massey, then dug into his pocket for his wallet. He found his driver's license and held it out to Seebeck. Its leading edge quivered noticeably. A slight smile creased Seebeck's face.
Jaime, did you kill this guy?
No, sir.
Then relax.
He took the ID and examined it. Jaime pointed at the steel box.
I closed a ticket on this winch today. I just turn a key like he says on the work order.
Where's the work order?
On the pocket PC in my truck.
Do you have the key to this winch housing?
Jaime nodded and produced a barcode labeled keychain with 3 keys.
You activated this winch today? What time?
About 9:30. I can tell you exactly from the work order.
Seebeck motioned for the keys, then used them to unlock the housing. He flipped it open with the tip of his pen. Inside, there was an electric winch with another keyhole in its face.
What's the 3rd key for?
Manual override for the front gate.
So you turned the key, the winch activated and pulled the cable,
Seebeck leaned over,
out of the ground.
No, senor, no cable, just the winch motor.
The others rolled their eyes in unison.
Jaime, if you were sent by your company to do this, then you don't have much to worry about. What's the purpose of this winch anyway?
Jaime shrugged.
I not run it before.
Can you get me that work order?
Yes, sir.
Jaime walked toward his truck. Pietro was looking down the length of the cable.
What exactly happened, Detective Seebeck?
Someone built this winch and the housing, then buried a steel cable in the soil. Running the winch stretched the cable across the dirt road at neck level.
The 2 Cyberstorm representatives looked confused. Pietro put a hand to his chin.
Are you sure that it's not a chain across the road?
Why bury it? Why do it at all when you have a steel gate at the entrance?
Pietro was at a loss. Jaime returned and pushed his pocket PC into Seebeck's face. He shadowed the screen with his calloused hand and pointed to the work order displayed there.
See, he says, run the antenna lifting winch until it stops.
Seebeck took the handheld computer and with Mance studied the data fields on screen.
Nathan, we're going to need a search warrant for the property management firm. Put their office under surveillance until we get a team over there. Also, get me a case number and get me Berkow's notes. I'm taking over the investigation. Everything goes through me from this point forward.
He looked up at Jaime.
Jaime, we're going to want to chat with you at the sheriff's station.
Señor, I didn't do anything.
I know, Jaime. That's why you want to cooperate while we arrange a search warrant for your employer.
Pietro interposed himself.
Detective Seebeck.
Counselor, this cable assembly was maintained by your property management firm, which would indicate they had prior knowledge of it. Would you prefer to make Cyberstorm the responsible party, or does Cyberstorm want to cooperate with my investigation?
Pietro pursed his lips, then turned to Jaime. Jaime, don't worry, go with them, do everything they say, tell them everything you know.
I don't know anything, Señor Pietro.
I know that, Jaime, but I think it best that you do what Detective Seebeck says.
I am a U.S. citizen. Am I under arrest?
Seebeck looked to Mance. Mance stepped in.
No, Jaime, we're just gonna talk. You can leave the pickup truck here. We'll take care of that.
Mance motioned for Jaime to move toward the patrol cars and started escorting him away. Pietro nodded to Massey.
Detective Seebeck, we'll contact your office for a copy of the police report. You know where to reach me.
Both men climbed back into the Range Rover and sped off to find a better wireless signal. Seebeck looked along the length of cable. Would someone really have built this just to kill a person? He could think of easier ways to kill someone. He clamped back a smile. This wasn't a murder-suicide or a botched drug deal. It might actually be a premeditated killing. Was it wrong to hope so? Accident or murder, the victim was dead. Nothing would change that. So what was wrong with hoping it was murder? Pondering this, Seebeck turned and walked back to the front gate. Chapter 3, Black Box. Seebeck, Mance, and three county deputies crowded around a post-it note slathered computer monitor in the cubicle of a nondescript company in a generic office park in Thousand Oaks. Tractor trailers hissed by on the freeway just beyond the thin stucco walls, but officers were intent, leaning over the shoulders of Deputy Aaron Larson, the county sheriff's only computer fraud specialist. Larson was in his late 20s with an air of military orderliness, buzz-cut hair, athletic build, and a square jaw. He had a boyish enthusiasm for ferreting out larceny. At such times, he'd smile and shake his head in slow-motion disbelief over what people thought they could get away with. Larson's computer screen scrolled rows of text.
This log lists IP addresses making connections to their server. Notice that we've got a number of connections at around the time our target work ticket was created.
He alt-tabbed over to a custom property management program.
I spoke with the secretary, and she said they're able to accept work tickets from clients through a secure web page.
Seebeck nodded. So the request didn't necessarily come from this office.
Right.
Larson flipped back to the custom application.
The requester field here claims the ticket was submitted by this Chopra Singh person at Cyberstorm Entertainment.
But wait, that's not where the connection actually originated. Larson minimized all the windows except the weblog. He highlighted a single line.
This was the connection that created the work order. When I do a who is lookup on the IP address,
he switched screens.
Voila.
A Who Is lookup page displayed the domain as owned by Alcyon Insurance Corporation of Woodland Hills, California. Seebeck read the small type.
Then the work order originated from this company in Woodland Hills.
Maybe, maybe not.
You think the address was spoofed?
The only way to find out is to get a warrant for their weblogs.
Another deputy entered the cramped office.
Sergeant, there's a news van outside.
Seebeck waved him off and kept his gaze on Larson.
So, no one in this management firm created the work order that killed Pavlos?
Seems unlikely.
Seebeck eyed the screen.
Is this sort of internet work order system typical for a hole-in-the-wall company like this?
Larson shook his head slowly and smiled.
No, it's not. This is pretty slick. The office manager said their parent company developed it for them.
You'll never guess who the parent company is.
Cyberstorm Entertainment.
Larson touched his finger to his nose.
Very good, Sergeant.
Just then, the radios crackled to life again. Seebeck turned to listen.
Units in vicinity of Westlake, 1054 at 3000 Westlake Boulevard reported. Be advised, 1029H, 1198 with building security.
Seebeck exchanged looks with the other officers. Another dead body had been found.
What the hell?
The address tugged at Seebeck's memory. He pulled Gordon Pietro's business card out of his pocket. At least his memory hadn't failed him. The new body had been found at Cyberstorm Entertainment. As far as Seebeck could tell, entertainment companies came in two flavors. Shady operations skirting tax, drug, and racketeering laws, or phenomenally successful corporate empires wielding immense influence worldwide. There was very little middle ground, and the transformation from one to the other seemed to happen in the wee hours after dark. With signage rights on a 10-story office building, Cyberstorm had evidently made that transformation. The latest body had been found in a security vestibule, a tiny room controlling access to what the employees called a server farm. The small entry chamber reminded Seebeck of an airlock.
The server farm was filled with rack-mounted servers, their LEDs flickering away in the semi-darkness of emergency lights. Through the glass, Seebeck could see several employees moving about. They were still monitoring the machines. It was hard to see them clearly because the vestibule windows were fogged with a yellowish film. Residue from burning human fat. The victim had been electrocuted in dramatic fashion. Seebeck stood in the dim glow of emergency lights alongside the building's chief operating engineer, Cyberstorm's network services director, county paramedics, a city power company foreman, and the president and CEO of Cyberstorm, Ken Cavalt. Cavalt was in his late 30s, tall and lean with spiky hair. His black short-sleeved silk shirt revealed death skull tattoos on his forearms, and he had the sort of deep tan and wrinkles one gets after years of surfing. He looked more like an aging rock star than a corporate executive. He hadn't said a word since they arrived. Seebeck turned to the power and light foreman.
The primary power's been cut?
The building engineer responded instead.
Yes, sir.
Seebeck turned to him.
Then those computers are running on backup power?
Right.
Then let's get that room evacuated.
There's another exit like this one, but it could be just as dangerous. I told the techs to stay put for now.
Seebeck nodded.
Who can tell me what happened?
The engineer and network services director looked to each other. The engineer already had the floor.
About a half hour ago, one of the Cyberstorm guys was electrocuted going through the inner security door. I don't know how it's possible, but the tech said he was standing there with smoke coming off his shoulders for about 30 seconds before he keeled over. And there he is.
Cavalt let out a hiss of disgust and shook his head ruefully. Seebeck ignored him.
The Cyberstorm guys? So you're not a Cyberstorm employee?
The engineer shook his head.
No, I work for the building owner.
And who owns the building?
Eyes shifted from person to person for a moment or two until Cavalt spoke up.
It's part of a real estate investment trust with a majority share held by Cyberstorm.
Seebeck turned back to the engineer.
So you are a Cyberstorm employee?
Cavalt interposed again.
No, the trust is not the same legal entity as Cyberstorm, and the trust outsources the engineering, security, and other building functions.
Seebeck could already imagine lawyers pointing fingers at each other for the next decade.
Forget that. Has anyone entered or left the scene since the incident?
All the men shook their heads.
Are there electrical blueprints for this entryway? Any recent unpermitted modifications I should know about?
An edge crept into the lead engineer's voice.
We don't do unpermitted construction here. All this equipment was signed off on by the city and fire inspectors 2 years ago, and we have the occupancy permit to prove it.
The guy looked to be about 50, a broad-shouldered Latino with a Marine Corps tattoo on his forearm. Seebeck figured this guy wasn't going to take any shit. He watched as the engineer moved to a flat-paneled workstation on a nearby desk and spun the panel to face them all. In a moment, the engineer brought up a 3D map of their location. The map was a series of clean vector lines in primary colors. The engineer tapped keys, highlighting a colored layer to emphasize each word.
Plumbing, HVAC, fire safety, electrical.
The image zoomed in. It was like a video game with transparent walls. They were now looking at a computer image of the vestibule, and Seebeck could see the yellow electrical lines running down through the doorframe to the combination magstrip keypad in the door's strike plate. No wonder the engineer had an attitude. He had every damned screw modeled in 3D.
There's no power source in that wall sufficient to electrocute a man like that, and even if there was, the breaker should have tripped. There's a short somewhere, probably to a trunk line. Maybe it electrified the doorframe.
The power company guy leaned in.
What's going into the server farm? Three-phase 480?
Yeah, but it's coming up through the floor. There's a trunk line running through a vertical penetration. The decking was reinforced to hold the weight of the racks, and there's a fiber backbone.
Gentlemen, Seebeck stepped between them. I need all non-emergency personnel evacuated from Cyberstorm's office space. Nathan, I want an outer perimeter established at all stairwell and elevator entrances. We set up command and control in this area just outside the vestibule. I want interviews from everyone evacuated.
The network director turned to Seebeck.
We have five floors in this building. Is it really necessary to evacuate them all?
two of your co-workers are dead today from unrelated accidents. I find that an implausible coincidence.
The network director's face contorted.
Two? That's correct. I'll let your illustrious leader fill you in.
The Cyberstorm folks turned to the company president. Kvalt was gnawing on his fingernails in irritation or concentration. It was hard to tell which. He finally spoke without looking at anybody.
Lamont, switch over to the mirror site, then evacuate the office.
Seebeck leveled a gaze.
You'll evacuate the building now. If you have any illusions about who's in charge here, I can give you a timeout in the county lockup.
Kvalt was about to speak, but thought better of it. He just marched off down the hall. His people followed. Seebeck nodded to Mance, who pursued Kvalt like a Rottweiler going after a toddler. Seebeck grabbed the network services director, who was also leaving.
Not you. You're staying here.
Seebeck had seen his share of fatal accidents in 14 years with the department, and he knew that workplace fatalities drew paperwork like blowflies to a corpse. OSHA inspectors, insurance investigators, reporters, lawyers, and building management all were waiting in the wings, but for now, Seebeck posted deputies to keep non-governmental and non-essential personnel out of his crime scene. The main power was off, and they established radio communications to monitor a lockout on the DWP power vault. After running a few tests with a voltmeter, the engineer and power company foreman determined that the door frames were not electrified. They instructed the data center employees to open the second exit and let the police and firemen in. Then they evacuated the techs. The crime scene was now free of civilians. Seebeck was surprised at how warm and stuffy the room had become. The AC hadn't been off all that long. He glanced around at the dozens of rack-mounted computers clicking away. That was a lot of BTUs. That's probably why they had an entry vestibule, to keep the cold air in. He turned to the engineer.
What are these machines for, anyway?
People playing games with each other over the internet. My grandson plays.
Seebeck had heard of this sort of thing. He had no idea it involved so much hardware. It looked expensive. They moved to the inner security door. The victim lay just beyond the glass, and they got their first good look at him. As a patrolman, Seebeck had seen the carnage of 100 car wrecks, but the network director lost it and excused himself. As Seebeck suspected, the engineer wasn't much affected.
That poor son of a bitch. A Vietnam vet, Seebeck thought.
It was hard to reconcile the human resources photo with the remains that lay before them. The victim's face was in distorted agony, or at least the involuntary muscle spasms of electrocution. His eyeballs hung out over the cheeks. His hair had mostly burned off his head. His whole face was blistered, but Seebeck already knew who it was. A lead programmer named Chopra Singh, the name on the spoof Potrero Canyon work order. There was no longer any doubt that these were murders. He just had to find the evidence. Seebeck had the power company foreman test the door with a voltmeter again just to be sure, and then moved aside for nearby firemen who pushed into the vestibule. The stench of burnt flesh and hair hit them, sending groans and gasps through the team.
Gary, get some video.
The photographer moved in, and bright light filled the space. Afterward, the paramedics confirmed the obvious. The victim was deceased. The vestibule was too small for both the body and the investigators, so they scanned the scene from the narrow doorway. Unlike most murder scenes, Seebeck didn't think the victim's body would contain much evidence, so he didn't start there. Instead, he had it covered with a plastic tarp and brought back the power company foreman.
I need to find out what electrified this door, and I need to find out fast.
There's no danger, Sergeant. The power's off in the whole building.
I'm not worried about just this building.
The foreman paused for a moment to digest that, and then nodded gravely. Soon Seebeck and the foreman crowded into the open doorway just above the now covered body. It was far from ideal, but Seebeck felt time was of the essence. The door jamb looked normal, but after unscrewing the strike plate, the foreman got a crowbar into the aluminum frame and pried off the cover with a resounding crack. What it concealed looked strange even to Seebeck. A small wire ran up the inside of the doorframe from the floor and into the back of the keypad and magstripe reader. but another, much thicker wire, ran down from the ceiling and was bolted with copper leads to the frame itself. Seebeck looked to the power company foreman.
I don't remember that on the engineer's blueprint.
The foreman moved in alongside.
That's 480 cable. You could power an industrial grinder with that.
Seebeck pointed up at the ceiling. Fiberglass ladders were brought in along with head-mounted lights. Soon, they pushed up through the drop ceiling and into the plenum. Their lights revealed fire coating sprayed over the steel beams and metal decking on the floor above. HVAC ducts and bundles of cables traversed the space. It was here that they found the black box. At least, that's what it looked like. A black metal housing into which the 480-volt line fed before running back out the far side. A thin gray cable also led into the black box. Seebeck focused his light beam, tracing the various lines from their vanishing points in the darkness.
All right, that's as far as we go.
It took the bomb squad 2 hours to clear the scene. When they finally gave the all clear, more ladders were brought in and more ceiling tiles removed. Until Seebeck, Mance, Deputy Aaron Larson, and the county's lead bomb technician, Deputy Bill Greer, were able to convene a precarious meeting with their heads poking through the drop ceiling around the now-open black box. Greer was a serene 40-year-old who might as well have been teaching a cooking class as he flipped up his blast helmet visor and pointed to the metal cover in his hand.
Fairly standard project enclosure,
he gestured to the open base still bolted to the HVAC duct. The 480-volt wire led through a cluster of circuit boards and smaller wires.
This is basically a switch, Sergeant. Whoever set this up could electrify the doorframe through this box.
Larson pointed to a network port in the side of the black box, then traced his finger to a smaller circuit board attached to it.
Check this out. It's a web server on a chip. It's got a tiny TCP/IP stack. They're used for controlling devices like doors and lights from an IP network.
I checked. They've got them all over the building. Larson slid his hand along a Cat5 cable extending from the board into the darkness.
This box is linked to their network, and their network is connected to the internet. It's conceivable that someone with the right passwords could have activated this switch from anywhere in the world.
Could the switch be set to activate when a certain person swiped their access card at the security door?
Probably. I just don't know enough about these cards yet.
How long has the switch been here?
Greer looked at the back of the enclosure.
It was covered in dust when we got to it.
So that vestibule door has probably been used thousands of times without incident. Then suddenly today it kills someone. We need to find out if Singh has ever been in this data center.
Larson jotted serial numbers down from the circuit board.
We can review their access logs, and there are security cameras.
Seebeck was shaking his head. It was too complex. They were all just guessing now. He stared at the switch for a moment more.
Gentlemen, I think it's time to call in the FBI. No offense, Aaron, but we just don't have the capabilities to deal with this.
By early evening, Seebeck stood near the building entrance, flanked by Mance and a uniformed deputy. A frenetic pack of reporters surrounded them, microphones pushed forward into a multicolored mass of foam rubber. Camera lenses glinted in the rear while reporters shouted questions. Seebeck motioned for silence until all he heard was the nearby generators on the satellite trucks.
This is what we know right now. At approximately 11:30 this morning, the body of Joseph Pavlos, an employee of Cyberstorm Entertainment, was discovered in a canyon off Potrero Road in Thousand Oaks. At approximately 2 p.m., a second Cyberstorm employee was electrocuted in what we now know to be a deliberate act. We're withholding the identity of the second victim pending notification of next of kin. We also believe Mr. Pavlos' death was a homicide and have requested assistance from the FBI.
Shouted questions erupted again. Seebeck motioned for silence.
It appears these employees were specifically targeted, and we have no reason to believe that the general public is in any danger. I caution Cyberstorm employees to be particularly vigilant and to report suspicious objects or packages to the police. I'll take questions now.
The parking lot erupted in shouting. Seebeck pointed to an Asian woman. He'd have to admit that he chose her first because she was drop-dead gorgeous.
Sergeant, you said you're bringing in the FBI. That means there's more to the case than the two murders?
The FBI has the resources and jurisdiction required to properly investigate this case.
Another reporter spoke up.
Can you describe precisely how the victims were killed?
We can't divulge precise methods at this time.
Can you give us a rough idea?
Seebeck hesitated.
At least one of the victims appears to have been murdered through the internet.
A buzz went through the press corps. That was their soundbite.
That's all we're prepared to say right now.
Chapter 4, God of Mischief. From his vantage point at a coffee house, Brian Gregg gazed across the street at the darkened windows of a French provincial mansion. The lush River Oaks section of Houston's Inner Loop had more than a few of these aging beauties, restored and pressed into service as quaint professional buildings. They sheltered doctor's offices, architectural firms, law firms, and branch offices of East Coast stockbrokers. It was this last species of suburban tenant that attracted Gregg. They were the weakest link in a valuable chain. One of the brokers there had installed a wireless access point in his office, but failed to change the default password and SSID. Better yet, the broker couldn't be bothered to shut his machine off at night. Gregg glanced down at his own laptop and adjusted a small Wi-Fi antenna to point more directly at the office windows. The broker's computer screen was displayed as a window on Gregg's laptop. Gregg had compromised the workstation days ago, first obtaining a network IP address from the router, and then gaining access to the broker's machine through the most basic of net BIOS assaults. The ports on the workstation were wide open, and over the course of several evening visits to the cafe, Gregg had escalated his privileges. He now owned their local network. Clearing the router's log would erase any evidence that he had been there. But all that was child's play compared to how he would use this exploit. In the past year, Gregg had evolved beyond simple credit card scams. He no longer prowled bars passing out portable magstripe readers to waiters and busboys and paying a bounty for each credit card number. Gregg now stole identities. His buddy, Hyder, had schooled him on the intricacies of spear phishing. It opened up a whole new world. Gregg was using the broker's workstation to conduct an email campaign to the firm's clientele. He had cribbed the phony marketing blather and graphics from the brokerage's own website, but what the email said was irrelevant. Gregg's goal was that the fish merely view the message. That was all it took. Gregg's email contained a poisoned JPEG of the brokerage logo. JPEGs were compressed image files. When the user viewed the email, the operating system ran a decompression algorithm to render the graphic on screen. It was this decompression algorithm that executed Gregg's malicious script and let him slip inside the user's system, granting him full access. There was a patch available for the decompression flaw, but older, rich folks typically had no clue about security patches. Gregg's script also installed a keylogger, which gave him account and password information to virtually everything the user did from then on, sending it to yet another compromised workstation offshore, where Gregg could pick it up at leisure. What sort of idiot hung the keys to his business out on the street, and more than that, broadcast a declaration from his router telling the world where the keys were? These people shouldn't be left home alone, much less put in charge of people's investments. Gregg cleaned up the router's connection log. More than likely, the scam wouldn't be detected for months, and even then, the company probably wouldn't tell their clients. They'd just close the barn door long after the Trojan horses were gone. So far, Gregg had a cache of nearly 2,000 high-net-worth identities to sell on the global market, and the Brazilians and Filipinos were snapping up everything he offered. Gregg knew he had a survival advantage in this new world. College was no longer the gateway to success. Apparently, people thought nothing of hanging their personal fortunes on technology they didn't understand. This would be their undoing. Gregg finished his mocha latte and glanced around the coffee house. Teens and kids in their early 20s. They had no idea he was raking in more than their corporate executive fathers. He looked like any other punk with long sideburns, a goatee, a winter cap, and a laptop. He was the kid you didn't notice because you were sick of looking at him. Gregg shut down his laptop and pulled a bootable flash drive from one USB port. He took a pair of needle-nose pliers and crushed the tiny drive like a walnut, tossing the pieces into a nearby trash can. The evidence was now destroyed. His laptop hard drive contained nothing but evangelical tracts. In the event of trouble, he would look like Jesus's number one fan. Just then, his cell phone played the Twilight Zone theme song. Greg tapped the wireless headphone in his ear.
Jason, where you at, man?
Corporate restaurant number 121. I'm just about done. What's your ETA?
Greg glanced at his watch, a Tag Heuer.
About 30 minutes.
Don't be late. Hey, I logged 16 more open APs uptown at lunch.
Put them on the map.
Already done.
I'm on my way. Meet me out back.
Greg glanced around at people getting into their leased cars to drive back to bank-owned homes. They were cattle. He viewed these oblivious drones with contempt. Greg headed uptown to Houston's West Loop, a cluster of skyscrapers just west of the city center that served as a sort of second skyline for people who felt the first one was too far away. Greg's partner, Jason Hyder, worked as a bartender in a corporate chain restaurant in the Galleria, close by the indoor ice rink. Hyder was 30-ish, but looked older. Back during the tech boom, he'd been some sort of vice president at a dot-com. Greg met Hyder in an IRC chat room dedicated to advanced cracking topics, authoring buffer overruns, algorithms for brute force password cracking, software vulnerability detection, that sort of thing. Hyder knew what he was talking about, and before long, they were dividing the work required to eavesdrop on Wi-Fi in airports and coffeehouses, stealing corporate logons where possible. They both shared a keen interest in technology and information, the tools of personal power. Hyder had taught Greg a lot in the last year, but nothing lately. Also, there was Hyder's recklessness. Hyder recently lost his license from a DUI and almost sunk them both by having his laptop in the car at the time. Greg was starting to watch him more carefully and disliked leaving him alone on a Saturday night for fear his indiscretions would get them both arrested. Fortunately, Greg had never confided his real name to Hyder. Greg reached the mall parking lot and circled around the bland tiers of stucco. He parked near the west entrance and waited. Hyder eventually straggled out to the parking lot with a cigarette hanging out of his mouth. It was a cold autumn night, and Hyder's breath smoked whether he was exhaling smoke or not. He wore a surplus M65 jacket that had seen better days. The guy looked particularly pathetic as he trudged toward Greg's car. Greg thought it would be a mercy to run him down. Hyder was a shadow of himself, as he often admitted. He took a last puff of his cigarette, tossed it, and got into the car.
Hey, Chico, where's the rave?
Greg gave him a once-over.
You carrying?
No, man. Well, just some crank.
Jace, dump that shit out right now or you can walk the fuck home for all I care. I've got a gig tonight and I don't need a canine unit giving the cops probable cause.
Christ, would you relax?
I don't relax. I stay focused. Friends don't let friends do drugs, especially when those friends can turn state's evidence.
All right, man, enough. I get the fucking idea.
Hyder turned the dome light switch off, then opened the car door and tossed a small Ziploc bag onto the asphalt. Greg started the car and pulled away.
Your brain is your only valuable tool, Jace. If you keep trashing it, you'll be worthless to me.
Oh, fuck off. If I had a stroke and sniffed glue, I'd wind up with your IQ. I mean, you spend all day watching hentai and playing video games. How smart can you be?
Video games was an oversimplification. Greg played massively multiplayer online games, or MMOGs, and as he stared coolly at his partner, it occurred to him that the game's complex societies contained far more social stimulation than anything that existed in Hyder's world. All the more reason for what was to come. Greg turned up the stereo to an Oakenfold mix and drowned out Hyder's voice. He drove out to the Katy Freeway and headed west, exiting onto State Highway 6 North, about 10 miles out of Houston. Highway 6 was a bleak four-lane stretch of concrete running through marshy ground and wide prairie fields, bordered by walls of trees, remnants of an agrarian past. Now the only growth was in strip malls, subdivisions, and office parks, sprouting like bunches of grapes off the vine of highway and separated by long stretches of nothing useful. Greg glowered at the road. He hadn't said a word in 10 minutes. Hyder just watched him.
What's with you tonight?
The fucking Filipinos. They posted a message telling me to meet them.
What for?
To pick up a new encryption key.
In person?
They're trying to keep the feds off their tail.
Fuck that! Sell the data to the Brazilians, man!
The Filipinos owe me for 500 identities already. If I don't pick up the code, I don't get paid.
Oh, what a pain in the ass! It's the last time we do business with them.
Greg flipped open his cell phone and started keying a text message while driving. He spoke to Hyder without looking at him.
We've got less than 40 minutes to showtime. The Filipinos can wait.
In a deserted cul-de-sac of an under-construction subdivision, half a dozen cars sat in the darkness. Knots of teenagers drank and smoked on their car hoods, laughing, arguing, or staring at the distant glow of the freeway. The pounding bass beat of rap music thudded into the cold night air from several car stereos all tuned to the same satellite radio channel. It reverberated in their chests as they threw rocks, shattering the newly installed windows of half-built homes. One kid zipped from car to car on a motorized scooter. They were a racially mixed group, mostly white, but with Asian, black, and Hispanic kids here and there. Their cars displayed their social class. A Mustang GT convertible with 18-inch chrome rims, late-model SUVs with vanity plates, mom's BMW. Economic class, not race, was the glue that bound them. A cell phone somewhere began a faint MIDI of Eine kleine Nacht music, and every girl in the group groped for her phone. The alpha girl, a thin, sexy blonde with low-cut denims and a midriff top, despite the cold, clucked her tongue at the others.
Y'all stole my ring!
She read the text message.
Austin, guys, turn down the music!
Stereos were quickly muted. The alpha girl used her best cheerleader voice to project the coordinates.
29.98075 and minus 95.687274. Everybody got that?
She repeated the coordinates while several others keyed them into GPS receivers. An athletically built African-American kid and his buddies stared at the console of his Lexus SUV. He keyed in the coordinates, and a graphical map appeared on the GPS LCD.
Tennant Field is closed down. My dad used to have his plane there. Let's roll!
A dozen kids paused to text message the coordinates to still other friends. The smart mob was forming and would be en route in minutes. Greg strode the tarmac in the pale moonlight, heading toward the dark silhouette of Hangar 2. The radio crackled in his head. He wore a bone conduction headset. It was capable of projecting sound directly into his skull, regardless of the noise in his surrounding environment. It was a useful tool for managing a for-profit rave. The radio crackled again.
Unit 19 to Unit 3, do you copy?
Greg touched his receiver.
Unit 3, talk to me.
The other white meat headed south on Farmington, range 2.3 miles.
Unit 3 was a lookout placed on the east perimeter with night vision goggles. Greg saw headlights turning into the main airport entrance.
Unit 20, Zone 1 is a blackout area.
10-4, Unit 3.
The headlights soon went out. Signature control was a never-ending battle for a prairie rave. Lines of car headlights were the enemy. Greg followed the thick generator cables running from the machine shop, past the parking lot, and up to the main hangar doors, where a subsonic bass beat rumbled, threatening to detach his retinas. A long roll of black duvetine hung down at the entrance, blocking the light and some of the noise within. A line of 100 or so teens hooted and hollered at the entrance, while a dozen heavy-set thugs in security windbreakers flanked the opening. The bouncers collected $20 from everybody at the door and then slipped an RFID-equipped neck badge around each teen's neck. Once tagged like cows, the patrons then proceeded through the metal detectors and into the main hangar. Each guard was equipped with a taser and pepper spray to quickly subdue and remove those inclined to disrupt the party. Dozens more patrolled the party inside. Greg ran a tight operation, and for this reason, he was always in demand by rave promoters. Tonight's promoter, a young Albanian drug dealer named Checo, stalked the tarmac nervously. But then again, he did everything nervously. Greg sniffed the night air, then walked past the bouncers into the head-pounding madness that was the rave. He pushed through the crowd of youths. Although he was several years older than most of them, Greg was of slimmer build and shorter stature. His lip piercing and arm tats gave him a menacing blue-collar appearance. But if anyone looked closely, the tattoos depicted entwined Cat 5 cable. Greg looked up at the DJ tower, flickering in the strobing laser light. Mixmaster Jamal was laying in a groove trance. The topless go-go dancers on 10-foot pedestals danced rhythmically. Greg smirked. The strippers weren't so much for the teen guys as the teen girls. Suburban girls acted scandalized, but they'd tell friends who'd have to see it for themselves. Where else would girls from good families see nude dancers? In the seedy strip club on the state highway? Hardly. Greg came inside specifically to find one of these girls from a good family. He moved through the crowd to the back of the hangar where the real money was made, at the pharmacy, where Checo's people sold ecstasy, meth, DMT, ketamine, and a dozen other recreation-grade pharmaceuticals, in addition to soft drinks and bottled water. Greg could usually spot his quarry easily. The sexy girl with a guy she didn't look particularly intimate with. A first date or perhaps just dancing together. He avoided girls with a group of female friends and girls who weren't having fun. He soon found his target. The girl was gorgeous. Perhaps 17, thin-waisted, but with a good rack shadowing her exposed midsection. Strands of glow sticks circled her belly and neck. It reminded Greg of Mardi Gras, and that was a good sign. He motioned to a couple of security guards and moved toward her. He timed it so he and the guards converged on the dancing couple. Greg tapped the guy on the shoulder, which sent him twirling around defensively. Greg held up two neck badges clearly marked All Area Access. Smiling, he looped one around the guy's neck. Few symbols have more power over the Western teenage mind than the All Area Access badge. The guy glanced at the uniformed security guards and evidently felt reassured. Greg, meanwhile, draped the badge over the laughing girl's neck. Her cleavage glistened with sweat. Greg leaned over and yelled into the guy's ear, "Your girl is fabulous, man. She should be dancing on the top floor, not down here." With that, Greg slid a couple of pills into the guy's hand and nodded his head toward the girl. He motioned for them both to follow and led them through the crowd as the burly security guards made a path. They soon reached the base of a steel staircase leading up to the DJ tower. It was roped off and flanked by a couple of bouncers. Greg leaned in close to one of the bouncers. "Tell me when she's taken a hit." The bouncer knew the drill. He watched poker-faced as the young guy popped what he probably thought was ecstasy into the girl's mouth. She washed it down with a swig of bottled water, laughed, then writhed with the pounding music. The bouncer nodded to Greg. Greg nodded back, and the rope was withdrawn to let them pass. As the boy passed by Greg, Greg leaned into his ear. "Play your cards right, man, and I'm gonna get you laid within the hour." The guy smiled back and gave Greg what the kid probably assumed was the universal playa's handshake. Greg watched them go. They were now in the holding pen, a controlled area where he could further reduce her inhibitions. The prostitutes there and Checo's men would make it all seem completely acceptable to go wild. Greg had successfully separated her from her support system. The rest should be easy. He was already erect in anticipation, but a little patience was required. Greg walked the perimeter for a good 15 minutes before heading back to the holding pen. He found the girl dancing on the mid-deck with a crowd of perhaps 20. Most of the women there were attractive and scantily clad. But these were Checo's whores and were of no interest to Greg. The 17-year-old target was laughing as her date danced between two women in G-strings. The girl was evidently flying high. On meth, the laser lights, the trance music, and the writhing motion were said to be hypnotic, accompanied by a surge of sexual arousal and perceived invulnerability. Or so Greg heard. He didn't take drugs himself. Greg radioed the security guard in the DJ tower. He couldn't even hear himself talk, but he knew the guard would hear. The guard looked out and saw Greg wave his arm slowly, then point at the girl dancing nearby. The guard leaned over to Mixmaster Jamal, and the DJ looked out at Greg. He nodded, and then snapped his fingers at the light board operator. Greg leaned over to her date. "What's your girl's name?" "Jennifer." "You want to see her tits?"
The guy stared for a second in dumb amazement, then burst out laughing.
Hell yeah!
Greg spoke her name into the radio and moved forward. A spotlight shone down onto Jennifer, and the DJ's voice came out like the booming voice of God.
Check out Jennifer! Is she hot or what?
A roar of lust arose from a thousand voices. Jennifer laughed and looked back to see her date and those around her shouting encouragement. The DJ's voice.
Let me see you move, baby!
The pounding bass moved back in, and she moved seductively to it. The other dancers moved away, and the laser lights enshrined her on the platform. The crowd surged in anticipation. Her eyes became wild with her potent sexuality. Each rhythmic gyration of her hips made a thousand guys howl. She was anonymous and powerful. But Greg was her new master. He looked back at Jennifer's date, smiled, and nodded to the DJ. The DJ's voice boomed down again.
Lose the top!
A thousand voices roared and took up the chant. The chant quickly fell in line with the music.
Lose the top! Lose the top!
Even the girls in the audience were cheering. Jennifer danced, soaking up the adoration. All eyes were on her body, screaming with lust. She was high enough that she didn't mind, and it seemed such a small thing to please them all. She first teased them by flashing her breasts, but that only drove the crowd wild for more. They knew they had her now. It was only a matter of wills. They took up the chant with renewed vigor.
Lose the top! Lose the top!
When she pulled her top off and danced, breasts jiggling free, the roar of joy rattled the walls. They motioned for her to toss her top down, and she dangled it above the outstretched hands of the lustful mob. Someone managed to grab it from her, and it was soon torn to pieces. Jennifer laughed and tugged at the all-area access badge around her neck. Girls around the room started flashing their breasts, sitting atop the shoulders of guys in the crowd. The DJ cranked up the music again, and the party moved on. But Greg moved in with one of Checo's men, holding a digital video camera. Jennifer smiled as they filmed her dancing topless in front of a thousand people. Her young, toned body glistened with sweat. Within a half hour, Jennifer was sitting on a sofa in the holding pen, sucking Greg off while her date looked on in shock. But her date didn't stop them. Greg moaned while one of Checo's men videotaped her. He looked to Jennifer's date.
You're after me.
When he ejaculated into her mouth, Greg felt a rush of power and sexual release. This was his drug. Greg didn't like whores. He liked to turn women into whores. The feeling of power was every bit as pleasurable as his ejaculation, perhaps more so. The fact that he was making money off this girl by doing a live porn webcast for Checo's website was even sweeter. She was being broadcast to the world, and the file would never go away. Greg made sure he was never filmed above the waist. As he moved away, he yelled,
"Bukkake!"
And a dozen men surrounded her. She was already sucking on her date's cock. The meth was working its magic on her as the cameraman zoomed in. Greg zipped up his pants and moved away, feeling the endorphins course through his body. Hyder suddenly appeared next to him, laughing.
You're an evil man, Loki.
Hyder handed him a bottle of water.
At least I got laid tonight.
Hyder poked a finger into Greg's chest. At least I don't need 1,000 people to orchestrate a